Okay, time to go to a new unit. The test was good, obviously. Well, I mean, it was good as a mean. I think it was about the same as what it was last time around. And as you might expect, that was the easiest one. So that was, I think, by far the highest last time, the highest mean. Which makes sense because it was really all review last time. Anyway, we'll talk about the test after lecture. But today, too late for it.
It's 9.
It's 9 and 30 seconds. Anyway, I think it would be perfect timing to stop just a little early and look at it today. Time to go on to chapter, I guess it's 6. Yeah, chapter 6, which is just some real basics about enzymes. And enzymes are a big deal in biochemistry because biochemistry deals with a lot of biochemical pathways, obviously, which are just strings of reactions, right? There are thousands of different chemical reactions occurring in a single cell of the about 100 trillion that you have in your body. So that's what really life is, chemistry, chemical reactions. And nearly every one of those chemical reactions is catalyzed by its own enzyme. So enzymes are huge in life, and that's why a huge fraction of your genome is dedicated to coding for how to build enzymes. You have how many genes as a human? It's true that we do have 46 chromosomes in any diploid cell of our body, so any non-gamete. About 20,000 roughly. One thing that the Human Genome Project taught us was that we have far fewer than we thought when we started looking for them. But anyway, that 20,000 or so genes that humans have, a hell of a lot of them are genes that tell the cell how to build a specific enzyme. So there are thousands of enzymes. Of course, there are other proteins as well that are important for other reasons. But we simply cannot exist without enzymes because the chemistry that life is, just on its own, without assistance, in other words, will not happen nearly quickly enough for us to stay alive. And that's, of course, what enzymes are all about, right? Enzymes are catalysts, chemically speaking. Catalyst is the more general term. Not all catalysts are enzymes, but all enzymes are catalysts. In general, though, what is a catalyst? Well, you told me what it does. Yeah, it is something that speeds up a reaction. So is temperature a catalyst? It speeds up reactions, at least some of them. So that's, again, what it does. These are things that it does. What is it? No, not necessarily. A catalyst is a substance. It's not just some concept, right? It's a real thing. It's a substance that participates in a reaction without being a reactant in that reaction. So the reaction that is catalyzed is able to proceed without the help of an enzyme, or without the help of a catalyst in general, not just an enzyme. And therefore, a catalyst is not necessary. You know, a reactant would be necessary. But another reason that we would call something a reactant is because a reactant in a chemical reaction doesn't stick around, right? It gets transformed into a product, by definition. Well, catalysts don't get turned into other things, at least not permanently. They might temporarily change, but then they're going to flip back into their original state as soon as the reaction is complete. And therefore, they are participants, but they're not reactants. And their job is to cause that reaction, which would happen without them being there, cause it to happen much quicker. And that's why they're absolutely vital to life, because the thousands of reactions that are necessary in any given cell don't happen nearly quick enough for life to persist. In this first slide, we're looking at a reversible reaction that is something I've already talked about. This is a biochemical reaction. It's happening right now inside you. What specifically is this? What do we have as reactants here? Carbon dioxide and water. What's on the right side? Carbonic acid, right. H2CO3, right? Why did I say this is important? Right, this is a really important part of your buffering system in your blood. You don't transport most of your CO2 as CO2. You actually transport it by transforming it in the plasma via this reaction. But in terms of this chapter, the reason this is a good example reaction to show you as a catalyzed reaction is because it not only is catalyzed, meaning that it doesn't happen very easily on its own as written here, even though it's possible, but it is catalyzed by an enzyme that is pretty superlative with respect to how quickly it makes this thing occur, makes this reaction occur. Anyone know what the actual enzyme is? Carbonic anhydrase, which notice is named for the reverse reaction, not the forward. It's typical that any given enzyme as a catalyst could work in either direction. So most of these reactions that we care about in biochemistry are at least partially reversible. Most reactions in chemistry are partially reversible. Some of them are so barely reversible, though, that we say that they're irreversible. Well, the ones in biochemistry are usually very reversible, with some exceptions, important exceptions that we'll talk about later. Anyway, this carbonic anhydrase enzyme gets its name because it takes water away from carbonic acid. That's what the anhydrase part of the name says. So when you move this to the left, you're taking two H's and an O off of this thing, which leaves carbon dioxide and the water. But it's very quick. And so it's a good that's why it's an opening figure in the book. It's enzymes in general are quick, but when you compare enzymes to each other, there's of course an order of how quick they are, and this is one of the quickest ones known. As we see in slide 2, when we list just some enzymes from biochemistry, carbonic anhydrase at the bottom of the list here has a catalyzed rate of about a million. That KCAT, which you see at the top of the column, is what kind of thing? What is K? It is a constant. What kind of constant? It's a rate constant, right? Lowercase k is a rate constant, so it tells you how fast this reaction is occurring. So the bigger the number, the faster it's occurring, right? Well, a million is a big number. What that really is referring to is that a single carbonic anhydrase enzyme, not the millions that you have, not the millions of copies that you have in one cell, but just a single enzyme molecule is able to turn about a million carbon dioxide and waters into carbonic acid, or the reverse, per second. That's very fast. The uncatalyzed K is the rate that the reaction occurs without an enzyme's help. And they are both important when you want to talk about the rate enhancement. So among these enzymes listed here, carbonic anhydrase is the fastest absolutely, meaning that it will cause the reaction to occur at a faster rate than any of the other reactions occurs with the help of its enzyme. But notice that it has the lowest rate enhancement. And that's because the reaction that it helps, even without any enzyme's help, would still would occur on its own and cause about... And in about 5 seconds, the reaction would occur. But notice the one on the top. Without the enzyme's help, takes about 78 million years for that reaction to occur, which is not quick enough for a cell, obviously. And so even though this top enzyme doesn't work as fast as carbonic anhydrase, it speeds up the uncatalyzed rate much more than carbonic anhydrase speeds up its uncatalyzed rate. That's what you see in the rate enhancement column in the right. 1.4 times 10 to the 17th power. I appreciate how big that is. It's speeding it up. Let's see, that is 100 million billion, right? Or 100,000 trillion. Either way you want to say it, it's a hell of an acceleration. And that's because these enzymes interact with reactants in such a way that it drastically makes it more likely for the reaction to actually take place between the reactants forming the products. Let's go to three. Here we have some sort of either oligopeptide or it may be part of a polypeptide. We don't know how long the chain is here, but it's some length of amino acid strung together, right? Or amino acid residues, because they are hooked together with peptide bonds. And what's being illustrated here is the notion of specificity. Enzymes are wonderful at accelerating reactions, but the whole reason that you have to devote such a huge portion of your genome to coding for many different kinds of enzymes is because there's no such thing as an all-around enzyme that will work perfectly on any reaction you want it to work. You wouldn't even want that to be the case if it were possible. Why would you not want there to be one general enzyme that will speed up any reaction you want it to speed up? Right, you would lose control. By having specificity between an enzyme and its reactants, the cell is able to exercise control over which reactions are allowed to proceed and which are basically turned off. Most of these biochemical reactions in the uncatalyzed rate are so slow that if the cell refuses to catalyze them, if it turns off an enzyme, for instance, then it effectively is turning off the reaction, even though a little might be made, a little product might be made. So you want specificity, actually, just for the purposes of controlling enzymes or regulating enzyme action. And specificity is an important hallmark of enzymes in general. But there are degrees of specificity. The enzyme that catalyzes this reaction has a certain specificity, but it's less specific than most enzymes. Most enzymes have a really high degree of specificity, and therefore there is just one or a couple substrates that are similar to each other that enzyme can work on. What is a substrate? Exactly. A substrate is simply the reactant or one of the reactants in a reaction that is catalyzed. So in any given reaction, reactants turn into products. If it happens to be a catalyzed reaction, we say that substrates get turned into products. And substrates do that by first binding to the enzyme temporarily. Okay, so back to this generality, this degree of specificity. Notice that the two amino acid residues that you see here on the left sharing this peptide bond, you have no idea what they are, right? Why? Yeah, they're just listed as our group one and our group two. So they could be any of the 20. Each one of them could be any of the 20 biological amino acids. And that's the point here. The specificity of this enzyme is such that it won't work on non-peptide bonds, so it doesn't just go breaking any sort of bond in any sort of organic compound. It has to be a peptide bond that it breaks, but it could be any peptide bond, because it doesn't matter what the two amino acids bonded by that peptide bond are. The active site of this enzyme will work on any pair. And so that's going to break it right where the peptide bond is that we've already discussed between the carboxyl end of one residue and the amino end of the other. So that would be an example of a peptidase. You know, enzymes have, unfortunately, any given enzyme can actually be called by several different names usually. Or not all of them, but many enzymes have several different names, any of which you can call them. And if it weren't difficult enough to think about all the weird enzyme names, it makes it even more difficult when they go by multiple nicknames. But that part of that having multiple names comes from the fact that you can talk about a specific enzyme, that will be one name, or you can say that it is an example of a class of enzymes, and that class has a name. For instance, the one that we saw in the previous slide, I guess I haven't said we're on four, but I haven't talked about four yet. On slide three, though, that would be an example of a peptidase because it breaks peptide bonds. Well, it's not the only peptidase. Peptidase isn't a specific enzyme. It's a class of enzymes. There are other peptidases, like you see in slide four, but they exhibit a higher degree of specificity. They're specific in the same way. They can cleave only peptide bonds and not other kinds of bonds, but it's more stringent than that. The requirement's more stringent. On the one at the top, which is trypsin as an example, it's not just any old peptide bond. It has to be a peptide bond between either a lysine or an arginine on one side and whatever other amino acid on the next. So the carboxyl end of either a lysine or an arginine and the amino of whatever is next, that's the degree of specificity that this one exhibits. Chymotrypsin on the bottom is an enzyme that has even greater specificity. So this is very specific now in this case, in the case of B here, because it has to be specifically an arginine and a glycine. Why do you know that this is glycine even if they didn't mark that? Because it has H2 on that alpha carbon, right? That's that R group, in other words, is simply an H, which is what glycine is. Anyway, specifically arginine and glycine. If it's anything else, then that specific enzyme, chymotrypsin, will just ignore it. And therefore, when we digest proteins, for instance, as part of the function of the digestive system, polypeptides are broken into chunks in different ways depending on which enzymes are acting on them. Eventually, they all get broken into individual amino acids, which are then small enough to be absorbed into the body through the intestinal epithelium. All right, well, let's go to five and classify enzymes in general based on function. Now, there's different ways to classify enzymes, but the chemists of the world got together and agreed to come up with a convention they all agreed on, in other words, that there are these six major classes, functional classes of enzymes. So any given enzyme can be put into one of these six classes based on what it does. And so these are big groups, and none of these, of course, is the name of an individual enzyme. There are many, many examples of each of these six. All right, and the names kind of give them the way in most cases. Oxidoreductases. Well, first of all, remember, or hopefully you already realize that things that end in ASE is a clue that you're talking about an enzyme, right? Enzymes specifically can be named in their non-ambiguous, non-systematic name. In other words, in the name that they've had for years and that name kind of just keeps being used, which is which is the case for a lot of enzymes. In those cases, those names are usually named either for the substrate that that enzyme naturally acts on, or for the job that it does, like carbonic anhydrase, right? It tells you what it acts on and what it does, both in its name. Well, these classes of enzymes tell you even more generally what these things do. So oxidoreductases obviously are named for the fact that the types of reactions they catalyze are redox reactions, oxidation-reduction reactions. And so what we're talking about here is a transfer of electrons, right? In redox reactions, there's always going to be a transfer of electrons removed from the thing that gets oxidized and stuck onto the thing that gets reduced. When something gets oxidized, something else gets reduced. But you do that by transferring electrons from one thing to another, and enzymes that help that out are oxidoreductases, several of which are important in the pathways that we'll be studying shortly. Transferases is also a pretty descriptive term. Functional groups, like the ones that we talked about, right? Carboxyl groups, carbonyl groups, phosphate groups, and so on. All those functional groups sometimes get shuttled around from one particle to another. And things that do that are transferases. Now, hydrolases, third one listed, are enzymes that perform hydrolysis. Hydrolysis is just a specific type of breaking down one big chunk into smaller chunks, right? There's different ways of doing that, but hydrolysis happens so often in biochemistry compared to other ways of breaking things apart that it gets its own class here. There are all kinds of hydrolases. And it should make sense to you that your digestive enzymes that breaks down your macromolecules that you put into your alimentary canal by eating, those are going to be hydrolases. You break apart these polymers by reversing what had to occur in order to build them, right? How do you build the macromolecules out of subunits? What kind of reactions? Condensation reactions. Well, the reverse of that is hydrolysis, right? So when you digest these things in this molecules that are small enough to actually enter cells and therefore enter your body, you're using hydrolases to do that. Lyases are next. Lyases usually involve a ring or a double bond even more often. But lyases are defined as enzymes that remove groups in ways other than through oxidation reduction or hydrolysis, because those already have their own classes. So if you remove a group to form a double bond, or you, in the reverse reaction, stick on a group in order to eliminate a double bond, that's a good bet that that's going to be a lyase doing that. The ly part of that word comes from a root that means loosen. Isomerases are also well named. You should guess just from that word that they are involved in isomerization, or transforming one isomer into another isomer, right? Isomers are different arrangements of the same exact atoms, correct? Isomers, if two particles are isomers of each other, they have exactly the same chemical formula. So the difference is just they're arranged differently in the carbon skeleton, and therefore you have to break certain bonds and form new bonds in order to rearrange those. But you're not sticking two things together to make a bigger thing, or you're not breaking two things apart to make two smaller ones. You're just rearranging that one thing into another isomer. And those are also really important in a lot of metabolic pathways in order for the next step in a pathway to proceed, like we'll see examples of later. And then finally, you have ligases. What is the root of ligase? What does that root mean? You should have learned about a specific kind of ligase in 181, right? What am I talking about? The one listed here. DNA ligase, remember that? Ligase comes from the same root that ligate comes from, or ligature. It means to bind, to tie. In other words, to bring things together. So these join molecules, and therefore, in terms of a subset of metabolism, what subset of metabolism is that? When you're joining two things together to make a bigger thing, what type of metabolism is that specifically? That's anabolism as opposed to catabolism, which breaks things down. When you build things up, that's an expensive process, right? Catabolism not only breaks things into smaller chunks, but yields energy because you're making them, you're putting them into a lower energy state, right? That's the basis of how we get energy from our food. We break it down into smaller chunks. But some of that energy gets used to build new molecules out of subunits, and that doesn't happen for free, which is why for ligases, we typically have as an energy source ATP molecules, which are hydrolyzed in the process. The hydrolysis of ATP, splitting it into two smaller chunks, will provide the energy to drive an endergonic reaction that a ligase is going to catalyze. Okay? Any questions on the six classes? Okay, let's go to six then. Now, I don't want you to copy down or memorize this list. The whole point of this table in slide six is that there are what we call cofactors that are important for enzyme action. And cofactors are simply helper particles that will allow an enzyme to become active. So an enzyme, a typical enzyme that requires a cofactor, if it doesn't have the cofactor attached to it at the time, we call it specifically an apoenzyme, APO. And in that state, it really isn't a catalyst. It's a non-functional enzyme at that point. But by binding to the cofactor, that will change the enzyme in such a way that it's able to operate as a catalyst to do whatever job it's supposed to do. And so in that situation, in other words, the enzyme with the cofactor, that's called a holoenzyme, H-O-L-O enzyme. So the holoenzymes are the functional ones. And notice that there are, in the first column, there are two kinds of cofactors. The cofactors are not enzymes. They are just things that the enzymes, I guess I should have explicitly said this before. Not all biological catalysts are enzymes. We originally said that they all were, but we then found exceptions to this. What are the exceptions? What are non-protein biological catalysts called? Or what are they made out of? Okay, let me back up and give you an even easier question. What are all enzymes made out of? They are proteins, right? So there are some catalysts in cells that aren't proteins. What are they made out of? No, but that's a good guess, because carbohydrates, because there are so many different ways that you can put monosaccharides together, you would think that they would have a hell of a lot of possible shapes, and shape is really what makes proteins perfect candidates for being enzymes, but it's not carbohydrates. Or at least we've never discovered any carbohydrates that are able to act as catalysts yet. It doesn't mean that none will ever be found. The other kinds of catalysts are made out of RNA. And RNA-based catalysts we don't call enzymes, we call ribozymes. As a matter of fact, if you think of a ribosome, which is the organelle of translation, right? That's how polypeptides are built. That ribosome is a combination of RNA and protein. And we originally assumed, because we thought all biological catalysts were proteins. We just originally assumed that the protein component of a ribosome was the catalytic component, but it turns out that the RNA is actually acting as a catalyst, and the protein part is more structural in a ribosome. Anyway, if you have a protein that is in its that is by itself unable to work because it's not attached to a cofactor, that's an apoenzyme. Cofactors are non-protein things that get stuck onto that protein apoenzyme, at least temporarily, if not permanently, in order to make it work. And what I was saying is that there are two major kinds of cofactors, two major kinds of things that get stuck onto these apoenzymes to turn them into the holoenzyme. There are coenzymes. Coenzymes are a type of cofactor, in other words. And coenzymes are organic particles. They have their own carbon skeleton as organic compounds. But they're not any of the 20 amino acids, right? Which is why they need to be stuck on to a protein that's already produced. Because when you produce a protein, you make it just out of amino acids to begin with. All right, anyway, nearly all the coenzymes listed here, and the ones that are important to the enzymes in your own body, come from vitamins. Vitamins are named for the fact that they're vital. You have to have them. You don't produce vitamins on your own, with the exception of vitamin D. But that's why we classify things as vitamins. They're vital, but you can't make your own versions of them. Therefore, you have to obtain them in your diet, right? Well, most of the vitamins you need, I mean, most people think about vitamins as just something they need to make sure they get enough of, whether it's just from their regular diet or through a supplement. They know they have to have them. But most of those vitamins, the reason you need them is because they act either directly or once they're slightly changed, so we call them vitamin derivatives, they act as cofactors, or coenzymes specifically, on certain enzymes and allow them to function. Without the vitamins' help, the enzyme is worthless, and therefore that reaction will not proceed. But then there are various kinds of metal ions that also act as cofactors. Metal ions are, of course, inorganic. So that's the big distinction between a coenzyme and a other kind of cofactor, is that these metal ions are inorganic. And you'll see these in several examples throughout the term. Okay, but don't memorize any of these specific ones, just the two classes. Okay, let's go to 7 now. Here we're looking at a graph of product versus time, right? And so the higher you are on the graph, the more product is formed. Well, this is a good way to show how well an enzyme works, because product formation is directly an indication of the progress of a reaction, right? If a reaction doesn't proceed, then there isn't any product that's formed. The faster that reaction proceeds, the more product occurs in a given amount of time, right? So what would the units of rate be if you're talking about how quickly a reaction proceeds? How would you describe the rate in terms of units? Some amount, and there's different ways you can say amount, right? You could say mass, you could say moles, whatever, but amount of product formed per time, right? In other words, in terms of this graph, the rate would simply be the slope, right? Because any given slope has units of y units per x units, rise over run, correct? But anyway, the magenta trace here is the one that corresponds to the enzymatically catalyzed reaction, the one that's helped out by the enzyme, whereas the black trace is occurring with no help. Remember that the enzyme isn't necessary, it just speeds things up. And you can clearly see that it speeds it up, because in any given amount of time, you have more product form in that same amount of time than you with the enzyme's help than you do without the enzyme. Notice the break here in the abscissa, or the x-axis. So really, this is way to the right in the next, off of campus. If you go along enough, though, notice that even without the enzyme's help, product formed is about the same as how much is formed with the enzyme's help. In other words, the magenta and the black traces come together if you let this thing go long enough. And so this is actually important in terms of how enzymes occur, because how much product is eventually formed is really all about equilibrium of a chemical reaction, right? And any given chemical reaction has its own equilibrium constant, which tells you how far to completion it goes. If you think back to general chemistry, you have two major aspects when you talk about reactions occurring, right? You have kinetics and you have equilibrium. Equilibrium is all about how far to the right a reaction proceeds with nothing saying about how quickly it proceeds, right? And kinetics is all about how fast it proceeds, not about how far it proceeds. So enzymes, by the fact that the pink and the black traces come together here, what this is saying is that enzymes, even though they drastically accelerate a reaction, they don't mess with the equilibrium at all. How much eventually will be produced is still going to depend on what the equilibrium constant for that kind of reaction is. And if it's a large equilibrium constant, that means it's going to go very far to the right. If it's not, if it's very small, it's not going to go very far, even with an enzyme's help. But in the short run, the enzyme is going to produce a lot more product in a given amount of time because it drastically accelerates the rate without affecting the equilibrium. Okay, let's go to the next graph then in slide 8 and talk about free energy. Free energy is something you should have discussed in other courses, probably several courses. What do we use to symbolize free energy? We use G, which stands for Gibbs. It used to be called Gibbs free energy. Sometimes it's just called free energy. Sometimes it's called the Gibbs function. They all refer to the same thing, which is really just a concept. Free energy is just a concept. It refers to how much energy is available to do something useful, to do some sort of work, in other words. And so any system has a value of G at any given moment. And by system here, I'm referring to a thermodynamic system, which, like I said before, can be anything as long as you define it. So any given chemical reaction is an example of a thermodynamic system, if that's how you define it. And there is a value of free energy associated with the collection of reactants, however many there are in this reaction. They have a certain value of free energy, or G, and so do the products, however many there are of those. Okay? In this particular example, this happens to be a reaction in which the products feature a lower value of G than the reactants or substrates. But it could be the other way around, of course. And so it's important to understand the difference between G and delta G. Delta notation in science just is change, right? So mathematically, delta G equals what? G final minus G initial, right? Or G of products minus G of substrates. So any given height on this graph, any given Y value is G, not delta G. Delta G has to be a difference between two values of two Y values. So delta G, as you see here graphically, is the difference between the two dashed blue lines. In other words, it's how much the products differ in their free energy value compared to the substrates. Another important part of this graph is that to get to the products from the reactants, in order for a reaction to proceed, it is not just a blip that changes substrate immediately into product, like magic. These are real things, reactants and products, made of real particles, right? Electrons are the things that are really mattering in a chemical reaction, right? Because we're leaving those nuclei alone. Chemistry is about what's happening to the electrons that are around those atomic nuclei. But the point here is that substrates don't just immediately transform into products. There has to be a transition state, which you see at the top of this graph. And that transition state isn't reactant or product. It's something that is no longer reactants. It's changed from what the reactants were, but it's not yet products. It's halfway in between, basically, or some it's partially in between. And this transition state, importantly, and as exemplified by the graph, is at a higher free energy level than either the substrate or the product. Now, another thing that we can say about G, or free energy in general, is that higher levels of G correspond to greater instability, or less stability, however you want to say it. Things that have high G are unstable and therefore tend to be very short-lived. They don't hang around very long, in other words, and that's true for this transition state of any given chemical reaction. So even though the transition state has to exist, it has to come into existence before it can then be transformed into the product, it is so fleeting, so short-lived, so transient, that it's not something that you go into a lab and measure how much of it you have. Really, all that you can really measure are substrates and products because this transition state is so short-lived. But the fact that it's so unstable and therefore has this higher G is really what constrains a chemical reaction like this one, which is really a downhill reaction in terms of free energy, right? Any reaction in which the products have a lower G value than the substrates, or than the reactants, whether it's catalyzed or not, that is a downhill reaction energetically, right? And therefore should happen on its own. In other words, it should be spontaneous, right? Well, that is a major utility of the concept of delta G. G is the value at any given moment of either the reactant or the product or the transition state. Delta G is how much products and reactants differ in their individual G values. And the delta G value and its sign tell you a lot about a chemical reaction. All right, so since it's always defined as final minus initial, it's possible for delta G to either be negative, zero, or positive, right? If it is negative, which it is here, then that means the G value for the products is less than the G value of the reactants. And any negative G value for a reaction means that for those conditions, that reaction is spontaneous, meaning that it will occur on its own. It is able to occur on its own. But spontaneous does not at all necessarily mean quick. Spontaneous means that it will happen. You might have to wait a million years or whatever. Okay? On the other hand, a positive value of delta G, which would be the other, which would be a product higher than substrates on the graph, that refers to a non-spontaneous reaction, which is never going to happen on its own. Right? Non-spontaneous reaction requires input of energy to cause it to happen. So delta G's sign tells you about whether something is non-spontaneous or spontaneous. If it's exactly zero, If products and reactants have the same G value under those conditions, then that simply means the reaction is at equilibrium. And it's just as likely for reactants to get turned into products as it is for products to get turned into reactants, which is why, really, as a spectator, you see nothing happening, right? There's no net change in either direction. So those are the three possibilities. And the magnitude of G tells you how much energy is going to be required or liberated if this thing occurs. So spontaneous and non-spontaneous are two words that refer to whether it will happen on its own. What are corresponding words that refer to which way energy is going? In other words, whether energy is released or energy is required. What is it? Well, that's a different thermodynamic variable that we haven't even talked about. Enthalpy is heat of the reaction. No, what I'm talking about is endergonic versus exergonic. Endergonic, endo meaning in, simply means energy requiring. An endergonic reaction is one that features a positive value for delta G. This is not an example of that, because a positive value of delta G, since delta G is G final minus G initial, would have to mean that the product's G is bigger than the reactant's G, right? That would be an uphill reaction. An endergonic reaction is going to be non-spontaneous for that reason. It's not going to happen on its own because it requires energy to get it to that product state. A negative value of delta G is classified as spontaneous in terms of whether it will happen on its own, but it's also classified as exergonic because energy is released if that reaction proceeds. Okay? And the amount of energy that's released corresponds to delta G, the magnitude of delta G. The negative just means that it's released. Okay, now, any given reaction could proceed in a single step, many different steps, but however the route is, whatever route is taken in getting from the initial reactants to the final products, that doesn't actually matter in terms of energy change, free energy change, I should say. In other words, the only thing that matters is what the G value is for the initial reactants and what the G value is for the final products. If you think about, for instance, combustion of glucose, you know, you put flame to glucose and you turn it into carbon dioxide and water in one shot. That's a different way of getting from A to B than it is than what happens in your cells, right? When you use cellular respiration, well, glycolysis and then cellular respiration to oxidize your glucose, you end up with exactly the same products as when you burn it, CO2 and water. But you've done it in a stepwise fashion. Doesn't matter in terms of how much the overall energy change is. They both ways feature the same delta G. Okay? So delta G really is only is taking into account what the beginning and what the end is. And even in this graph that shows you two different possible transition states, one if it's not helped by an enzyme and one with it being helped by an enzyme, notice that neither of those has any effect at all on delta G. So this is a really important concept about enzymes in general again. Enzymes never change the value of delta G because the only thing that matters to that is what the reactants are and what the products are. It doesn't matter whether it's catalyzed or uncatalyzed. It's the same delta G. But we haven't talked about these other arrows above the top dashed blue line. And these arrows are also changes in G, right? They're vertical range on the graph. This book calls them delta G double dagger. Other books will call that size of that hill E sub A, for instance, which stands for activation energy. Activation energy refers to the height of this little hill that you have to get over in order to proceed from substrate through transition state to product. And the reason this is really so important in this chapter is because although enzymes never change the value of D, they always change the value of E sub A, or delta G double dagger, as this book calls it. So enzymes operate in a variety of ways, depending on what the enzyme is and what the substrate is. But they always operate, generally speaking, by lowering the value of activation energy. Graphically, that's illustrated by the catalyzed dashed black line. Notice it's a much smaller hill that has to be gotten over. In the presence of an enzyme, that hill can get so low that just the thermal energy of particles moving around in solution is enough to drag it over that hill. And once you get over that hill, it's downhill from there, right? Which is why it will proceed readily. But this also shows you why, if you don't have a catalyst, another way of making it occur faster is to heat it up, right? The faster you heat it up, the more thermal energy you have to get you over that higher hill. Well, that's a useful thing to do if you don't have a catalyst, and that would work in biological systems, in cells, in other words, if it weren't for the fact that that would destroy the cell. You can't heat a cell up and expect it to maintain its integrity. So we've evolved catalysts to do the same job that heating up would accomplish. Okay. In slide 9, we're looking at the relationship between delta G naught prime and KEQ prime. Now, this KEQ is a different constant compared to the K's we were looking at before. What is KEQ? That is the equilibrium constant, which is not a rate constant. It's not about how fast the reaction goes. It's about how far to completion it goes, right? And so K really is just the special value of Q at equilibrium, if you remember that from general chemistry. And the delta G naught prime and KEQ prime are related, as you see in the numbers here. And hopefully this will make sense to you. First of all, delta G naught prime, in case you're wondering what that means with respect to compared to just delta G. Delta G is whatever the value is at the whatever conditions you're measuring this thing in. Okay? We also have a set of numbers called delta G naught. Any given reaction will have delta G naught associated with it. That means under standard physical chemistry conditions, which is, you know, 25 centigrade and 1 molar concentration of all the participants and 0 pH. So that's what the naught is. And we usually don't pay attention to that in biochemistry nearly as much as delta G naught prime. The prime that we put on that is a different set of standard conditions. It's biochemical standard conditions, meaning that we redefine how we treat water. We let water's activity equal ones, basically so that it's ignored in the math. This makes the math easier. And we also say that with the prime notation, we're talking about a pH of 7, not of 0. In other words, we're talking about conditions that actually prevail in most living cells. So when we're talking about delta G naught prime, that's the value of delta G under physiological conditions in a typical cell, pH 7. Okay, so those values are the ones we want to pay attention to because that's what's really happening in something that's living. All right, but anyway, delta G and K, the equilibrium constant, are related. Well, like I said earlier, the bigger the equilibrium constant is, the farther to the right the reaction is going to proceed. What is K actually equal to? If you were to compute it, K equals what? KEQ equals what? It's the ratio of the product of the product concentrations, in other words, the concentrations of each product multiplied together as a numerator, divided by the concentrations of all the reactants multiplied together, right? And so if you just think about that ratio, the value of that fraction, the quotient, in other words, is going to be large if the numerator is larger than the denominator, right? Well, that means if the reaction proceeds in such a way that you end up, once you let it run to its completion, you end up with a lot more products than you have reactants, that's going to make that K value big, right? So the bigger the value, the farther this thing proceeds to the right, whether it's catalyzed or not. All right? And the smaller it is, the less farther to the right it's going to go. Well, delta G is related to that. The bigger the value of K, as you see on the bottom, the biggest value of K here is at the bottom, 10 to the fifth. The bigger and more negative, the magnitude is big, but it's becoming more and more negative, the delta G naught prime is. So something that has a big KEQ, you should in your mind say that's going to be something that wants to go way to the right. Products are wanting to form out of reactants. Well, that's a spontaneous reaction, right? Therefore, it makes sense that the delta G naught prime should be negative. Negative delta G's are spontaneous. And the more negative is, meaning the bigger the magnet, the absolute value is in the negative value, the more energy is going to be released, the more exergonic it's going to be. Just the opposite for the top of the table. 10 to the negative fifth is much smaller than 1. And therefore, that's going to feature a positive value of delta G naught prime. It's going to be an endergonic reaction. It's going to be a reaction, in other words, that you, if you want it to happen, have to force to happen by supplying energy. All right? What's the special thing about 1 for a KEQ? Well, at 1, that means the only way you're going to have a fraction equal 1 is if the numerator equals the denominator, right? The only way that's going to happen in terms of the definition of KEQ is if you have just as many products in terms of concentrations as you have reactants. In other words, this thing is at equilibrium, and therefore it's just what I told you as far as delta G is concerned. Delta G is 0. So those are the three possibilities in terms of the sign of delta G. Negative values, spontaneous, positive values, non-spontaneous, 0, equilibrium. Okay, in 10, what we see are just graphs similar to the ones I showed you before. Any given reaction features a transition state that is higher energy, higher free energy than either the substrate or the product. A is exactly the one we looked at before, so this is an endergonic and spontaneous reaction being portrayed here. But I said it's also possible for products to be higher in their G value than substrates, as you see in B, so that B corresponds to some non-spontaneous endergonic reaction with a positive value of delta G. Now, you might use an enzyme to cause either of these to actually happen soon. But whether you use an enzyme or not, B isn't going to happen unless you supply energy to do it, right? You have to get it up the hill. But in both cases, if you did use an enzyme, the hill above the higher G level, whether it's products or substrate, whichever one's higher, the height of the hill above that level is what activation energy is. And so an enzyme would make this happen faster, even though you have to provide energy even with the substrate, even with the enzyme, because that hill is lower. All right, let's go to 11. Just a couple more slides left, and these I can quickly get through. In 11, we're looking at a ribbon model of an overall polypeptide. And so this is an enzyme But the point of this, with the colors that are shown here, is that any given enzyme has a specific region on it, which is usually just a minor part of its overall surface. But that specific region, the business end of the enzyme, is of course the active site, right? The active site allows the enzyme to work as a catalyst, because that particular active site will allow for a lot of non-covalent interactions, all those three major kinds of non-covalent interactions that we were talking about before, right, to occur between that active site and a particular substrate. This explains why enzymes are specific. Only the right thing with the right, not only the right shape. Shape is important, because the more complementary the shape is of the substrate to the active site, the better the fit between the two, right? Like a lock and a key. But it's not just about that. The better the shape fit is between them, the closer the substrate particles can get to the particles that make up the protein, the enzyme. And remember that when we were talking about these interactions, these non-covalent interactions, hydrogen bonding, van der Waals forces, and electrostatic interactions, closeness really matters, right? You have to get very close for these things, especially van der Waals forces, to come into play. So that's possible if the substrate happens to have just the right fit for that active site, but it's not just because they fit together, it's because fitting together allows for a bunch of these non-covalent interactions to occur. That's actually what causes the reactants to get turned into the transition state, which then gets turned into the product. That's what allows the reaction to proceed. And what this slide is showing you is that the active site is made up of parts of the overall polypeptide that aren't necessarily near each other in primary structure. B represents the primary structure. Now, not all the amino acids are shown. You see that there's 129 of them total, but at positions 35, 52, and so on, these colored amino acids, which don't lie next to each other in the primary structure, come into close proximity at the active site to make up the shape of that active site. And this just shows you something that we've talked about many times before, that shape is everything when it comes to a protein's function. And overall, three-dimensional shape is all about how the polypeptide residues interact with each other because of their own non-covalent interactions. Well, plus covalent if there happen to be disulfide bonds. The rest of the enzyme, by the way, with the majority of the enzyme, which is not the active site, that's doing something else, like maybe anchoring it in a membrane. Yeah, go ahead.
You say the non-covalent interactions of the active site, that's what gives you that lower activation energy?
I said, well, what I wanted to say was that non-covalent interactions between the active site and the substrate that's fit into that active site are what lower the activation energy somehow. And that can happen various ways. For instance, if you're breaking one molecule into two, you have to break a bond to do that. It might be that the way it fits in there actually stresses the bond, making it easier for it to break. Or it could be if you have two reactants that need to be joined together. They can do that without help if they happen to not only come together, but come together in exactly the right orientation. If they just bounce off each other with their backs when it's this side that needs to come together, it's not going to happen easily on their own. But if they bind to the active site, that forces them to be in just the right orientation that they're going to react with each other. So it happens different ways. But it happens because of a short-lived or transient association, a short-lived non-covalent binding between substrate and active site. And that's why it's temporary, because it's covalent. If you covalently bonded a substrate to an enzyme, you would have it stuck there, right? Has to be a reversible thing, because the idea is that the substrate comes in, binds temporarily, gets turned into product, and then gets released from the enzyme. And, by the way, that's another big hallmark of enzymes in general, or catalysts in general, is that not only are they not reactants, because they don't get turned into products, they emerge after the process exactly like they were going into it. In other words, they're reusable. So as long as they still exist, as long as they don't get broken down, and as long as there's still more substrate around, it will get turned into product with the help of that same enzyme. In 12, we're looking at a lock and key analogy between the fit of a substrate and its active site on the enzyme that's specific for that kind of substrate. And this is pretty easy to understand, right? If it's just the right shape, it will come together nicely. And some enzymes might be like that, but most enzymes we've learned are actually more like 13, slide 13. Here, instead of it being a perfect fit already between either lock and key or hand and glove, they're both good analogies, between the substrate and the active site, the substrate here, notice, fits somewhat into the active site, but not perfectly. But as soon as it starts making these interactions that we've been talking about between the substrate and the active site, that causes a conformational change in the enzyme, which should be no surprise, right? When things bind to proteins in general, what happens is that you have a conformational change in that protein, like when a receptor binds its hormone, for instance. Well, that... In the case of an enzyme binding a substrate, when the conformational change in the enzyme occurs as a result of that substrate coming along, that changes the shape of the active site in such a way that the fit between the active site and the substrate is even better than it was before. So we call this induced fit, because the fit is induced by the presence of the substrate to begin with. And so I guess this is kind of analogous to the limp handshake versus someone who takes your hand actively, right? Someone who really takes your hand in a handshake is wrapping his or her hand around yours, making it a much better fit than someone who doesn't change, you know, just puts the hand out for you to grab. Induced fit really increases these number of hydrophobic interactions or these non-covalent interactions in general, and therefore allows for it to operate as a catalyst. All right, let's quit for the day and look at the test.